up this morning with the sun down shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Well, and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 575. NASDAQ Futures up 250. Do we have Mr. Kevin O'Neill in the house?
Yeah, good morning. What am I doing here today again?
You're subbing for Lou, who's on Southwest Air at the moment.
On Southwest Air, huh? Okay.
Yeah, he's fly Southwest. Remember when flight attendants, I almost said stewardesses, were all probably 25 years old and like blind, and they would sing to you when the thing took off. Fly Southwest.
Oh, they used to have a lot of fun on there. I haven't flown Southwest in quite a while, so I'm not sure what they do now. But there always was an element of fun with the staff there that they seemed like. First of all, it seemed like they enjoyed their jobs.
Yeah.
But they also tried to make it a little bit different for the passengers.
In the early 90s, we first started, we had a huge client out in Arizona.
How huge was he?
Well, he was almost as big as Keating.
Okay.
He had 58 different...
I thought you were going with physical size.
Oh, no. He was wasn't that big, but boy, he was a tough old bird. He was a navigator in World War II that got shot down and spent time in a POW camp. But he was a guy that would not spend anything that he didn't have to, right? He had this guy was telling you he had three islands up in the Bay of the Islands in Lake Huron. And Audrey and I went up there. I never saw anything like it. It was like three islands out of... House beautiful, and he had to barge out the dirt for the septic tank. He had to barge out like a refrigerator and everything he built the place with. It's really something. Anyway, they had a place up there before there was a Mackinac Bridge. They'd go up there literally in the 57 Chevy station wagon, get their ticket for the ferry, go to the movies, and they came out. It was their turn for the ferry, go across, and keep going. they were up there for years before they had any kind of running water in any of these places. You had to boil the water to do the dishes and every day, and they'd go up there for 3 months. It was nice. After 3-4 days, I was kind of done with it. That's just me, I guess. But
you have to like isolation to get into a situation like that.
Yeah, and but the people who own the Grand Trunk Railroad had an island. You had to get the islands from the Queen, and then after, I think he got his last one maybe in 1980 or something, 1970. And then you couldn't get them anymore. But it's just beautiful country up there. But there's, you know, it's mostly Indian still. I mean, it's Manitoulin Island. It's kind of, Manitoulin Island is like a peninsula. It's an island, but there's a waterway to maybe 10 feet wide separating it from the mainland. So I guess it's technically an island, but it's really like a big peninsula. And inside of that peninsula is this Bay of the Islands. And it's very similar to the, you ever go to Quetico to go canoeing?
No, I have not.
My brother Dan, who's by the way is an expert canoeist, been in a bunch of races and everything, he drags me and Bill Donovan, can you imagine that, up there after we graduated grad school, and just went straight there, and whatever year it was, we went through Portage into Canada. We went through customs in a canoe, and they're charging us for our dried eggs and stuff. It wasn't very much, but
yeah, no dairy tariffs.
Yeah. So we went up there. It was so early. The guy and his wife, the ranger and his wife, had just showed up when we showed up in the canoe. And the guy's like, "What are you guys doing here? We're going canoeing." And he goes, "The ice is only been off the water for like 2 weeks. You guys idiots."
don't capsize.
It was, well, you know, you bring your what's the soap that floats, Ivory? You bring your Ivory soap so you can go in a lake and take a bath. Well, one of those was enough. God,
yeah,
it was cold.
Okay.
Anyway, but where I'm getting to is the topography is the glacier essentially scraped off all the black dirt and deposited a lot of it in the Midwest, which is really why you have the Corn Belt in Iowa and Illinois, that we stole that dirt basically from places up north, right? And or the glacier stole it for us.
We hired a glacier to do it. We don't get our hands dirty.
No, everything is just kind of rock, and with some trees that somehow find a way to grow, and it's gotten some dirt as the trees have decayed. Well, this Bay of the Islands is sort of like that. When you look across, if you don't know where you're going, if you got a boat, everybody's got what do they call those things? Boston whalers, because they have like a small draft and outboards. Nobody has an inboard, because if you don't know where these islands are, you'll see like a bunch of geese. Looks like they're swimming on the water. They're not. They're standing on an island. It's like 6 inches below the waterline. If you don't know where they are, they're driving around. You even this guy had been up there 25 years. He'd lose like 3 or 4 propellers a summer. But, you know, you gotta love it. People anyway, they loved it up there. But he was he was a Keating guy. When I say a Keating guy, he was a developer.
Okay.
Huh? Yeah, and that was the guy who went to jail with the same as a loan issue. Remember?
The famous Keating Five, yep.
Yeah, and he's the one who built the incredible place that people ended up getting for 10 cents and 12 cents on the buck, the really fantastic resort there in North Scottsdale or whatever, anyway. But he was my source for all the information and the Resolution Trust and how dirty it all was and how these properties got. He was telling me they put together 7 or 8 properties, including the Phoenician, I think, for like 40 cents on the buck. And it's all had to be approved by Washington. And when it was, then they said, oh no, you can't do a small piece like that. Some of Bush One's buddies, but more to read about Bush One, he was not the grandfather dude that everybody, you know, I think he might have been one of the biggest crooks that ever ran as president. But he.
Well, Tom, what did he do? You know, how did he come up through the political ranks?
Well, he was a. You know, that's good. How did he get from being like a state?
But CIA.
I know, but how did he get from being like a representative? Was he in office before he was CIA, or was he like a state rep from Texas?
I don't know. We can pull up his sequence. But my point of raising it is, yeah, he was a spook. What do you think? What do you think he was like?
Yeah. Well, and his they came out and they said, oh no, you need to be able to do at least 10 properties. So the guys that were willing to pay like 40 went to somebody for like half of that. And, the guys from Washington, they basically let everybody else do all the work and then said, oh, no, we're doing it this way, and gave it to some of their friends for less. I mean, just that was, if you ever want to read, disgustingly, read a lot about America. And when I say America, I mean, obviously America is the people we know, the really good people here. They're all over the place. That's the America we love, right? But behind the scenes, there's like this other America. And it seems like almost every generation, people find a way to take the money from people who used to have it and give it to new people, right? And that was the Resolution Trust was the way that was done those days. And, you know, basically they gave people everybody else's money for 20 cents on the buck. And you go through there, and the guys, if you were in the know, Kevin, you can get all this on... you know, wrote a huge paper on it. Is remember that wacky guy Sherman Skolnick? Remember that name?
I don't.
He was this, well, obviously Jewish, very sort of unattractive dude because I think he spent his whole life in a wheelchair. So his parents didn't like straighten his teeth or anything. So when he went on TV, you're like, eh. But he was an attorney. He was a pretty brilliant attorney, and he was an absolute thorn. An original Mayor Daley's ass. Whenever he tried to do something, he'd come on TV and say how illegal it was and stuff. You know, but he was a Chicago name for a while. He was somebody who tried to keep the administration, I'll use the term, somewhat in line. And he ended up writing this big thing on the Resolution Trust. And if you were, I forget the numbers exactly, but if you were in, able to get in the group, you had to put up like 10% of your own money or 15%, and the government loaned you the other 85 or 90 to buy up these places for, you know, 20, 30 cents on the buck. And if you were really in the group, they lent you the first 10 or 15%, and then that became your capital, and then they lent you the rest. I mean, it was absolutely incredible what, I mean, now this guy spent way too much for the Phoenician, obviously, because the economy went flying way down. But when it came back after that time, this guy, I won't say what his last name was, but they would call him C.W., Charles C.W., who was like J.W. or, McClintock or something. His son, California was absolutely on its ass economically. Well, Arizona started to pick up a little bit. So the guy goes out to California, and there was an auction. They're started to build some golf courses in Arizona. The guy goes out to California for an auction for, what do you call those huge machines that, we used to call them road graders, but they're actually scrapers, big blade on the bottom. Where if you're going to take a golf course and make hills and fairways and stuff, you got to have those things. So he goes out to some auction in California, and the auction is, if you buy the first one, you get to buy four more at the same price. So the guy ends up bidding the first one, everybody's bidding on it, and then he bids something. He gets the thing for, I guess for a song, for a scraper. Then all the people go, hey, that's way too cheap. And he invokes the rule of the auction. Hey, wait a minute, I get to buy four more at this price. Well, the place like goes up in outrage. What are you talking about? You're stealing five? Well, he ends up, that was the rules. So he plunks them on trucks, takes them back to Arizona. One of the truckers screws up and loses a thing in a gorge. And sure enough, the trucker's got insurance. He gets paid full price for the thing, not what he paid for it at auction. But, and then find somebody who's, Kevin, these stories don't. And then he ends up lending it to two guys that are building this golf course. His lease per month is more than he paid for the damn things. That's what happens if you can catch a business turnaround. And what he taught me, Kevin, is people who feel they have to go crazy in the market every day and go trade. If you have, I'm going to say this is 1991, the guy probably had 40, 50 million bucks. If you make one or two trades a year, you got to be an orangutan to screw him up. He went, it's more like a CW story here, but the day after the crash in 1987, when the crash was on Monday, he shows up at his brokerage office. Now he's got no positions. And he's sitting there on the step with donuts and coffee for all the people in the brokerage firm. And he comes in and the guy goes, what are you doing here? Well, I'm going to wait a little while. I'm going to buy some stocks. So, Tuesday morning, I remember it like it was yesterday, markets are way down. And then the one guy here who allegedly started buying futures didn't have any money. Well, this guy, CW, buys, I don't know how many thousand shares of like nine different stocks or eight different stocks. By the end of the day, he had made $8 a share on average. Said, see you guys, and left.
Work up, you get it.
Yeah, but it's unreal. So, hey, our boys went down a little last night in L.A., huh?
They did, and, they got way behind. They rallied back, tied it at 7. I woke up for the rally, then I went back to sleep for the rest of the loss. But looking at it this morning, it looks like there's a little bit of friction between the manager and Seiya Suzuki, because they had scored one in the ninth to try and get back in the game, and they had first and second, and it wasn't something the manager called. Suzuki tried to steal third and got thrown out. Which is not good when you're down two runs.
No, that would not be good.
So it kind of killed the rally. Afterwards, usually the manager will kind of cover for the player. He kind of said it was, I think the word he used was inexcusable.
Really?
So which team do you think will have Seiya Suzuki next year?
Well, his buddies are all on the team.
Yeah, you can go to the Dodgers. Of course, we got Shota here.
Yeah, it's you know, they are trying to be a little more aggressive, but I don't know why you want to steal third there when you're down two.
Well, yeah, I mean, in that case, no, you don't, because you still need to score a couple, and I think they either had, yeah, I think they had one out because they had just scored on a sac fly. So they had bases loaded and nobody out. I think strategically it's not a very very smart move. So yeah, they've been running a lot more because they have to run a lot more. They haven't been getting extra base hits. So you have turned your singles into extra base hits. But yeah, inappropriate in that situation, I think. And it's kind of a shame because Suzuki's been probably arguably, anyway, their best hitter throughout the course of the season.
Well, he's also considered fundamentally pretty sound.
Yeah, except that he was boxing with balls in the outfield for a while there, which is why he's been the designated hitter most of the time.
I don't know where that came from. He was seemingly all of a sudden...
Yeah, he had won the Japanese League's equivalent of the Gold Glove.
I saw him like 3-4 games in a row at like different stadiums, and it seemed like every night he had a problem picking him up out of the lights or something. I mean,
point where I wonder if they, if they really shouldn't have been doing an eye exam on him. And like, some people just don't have good night vision. I don't. Competing, under the lights, like summertime softball, that kind of thing was never a big deal to me, but driving is.
Yeah,
I have to be careful making left turns when there's a concrete island in the middle because, especially if it's rainy, I just don't see it.
Yeah, well, so it's
my compensation for that is just make sure you square off your turns.
Well, that's the truth. Hey, what do you make of this? I'm just reading this thing this morning. Of course, everybody's been hearing about Taylor Swift endorsing Kamala Harris and. And Trump said something about
like I care about that. Huh?
Well, I don't really care all that much about it either, except Trump's of course response is the market will make you pay or something along that line. But in this one article here, and I can't believe that they would say this wrong, but maybe who the hell knows? Rebecca Picciotto, on CNBC.
Sounds like a nickname.
Yeah. So says that Taylor Swift says the only reason why she did it is because in August, Trump previously suggested he would accept the Swift endorsement if he secured it. In August, fake AI generated images of Swift supporting Trump circulated on social media. And then Trump posted on his True Social account, "I accept." So in her Tuesday night post, Swift said her endorsement of Harris was partly in response to those AI images which had her endorsing Trump, which she never did. Could that possibly be true?
Well, it could be true. It could be a fake. I don't know why that would influence her endorsement.
Have you guys seen what she was or what you're talking about?
No.
It's a joke. I mean, he knew it was a joke.
Okay.
But it's just kind of a funny internet thing.
All right.
Yeah,
so
there could be. I could see her motivation being, "Hey, I've been for the Democrat all along. I just want to set the record straight." Okay, but honestly, who cares what a celebrity thinks?
Well,
if you're that mindless, I wish you wouldn't vote. Period. I don't care which. If it's Hulk Hogan, if that's going to influence you, I wish you really wouldn't vote. But. Because we don't need more stupid people having any influence in this country.
Well, I mean, when you look at this, and I'm trying to pick out the pluses and minuses of both, and for the regulatory business that I'm in, I'm going to say Trump would probably be, an advantage, especially with these guys pouring through with this fiduciary rule, which is nothing like the fiduciary rule that anybody would think it might be. I was explaining it to my attorney buddies last night, and I go, if this was applied to you, you couldn't be an attorney. And he goes, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "Because if somebody comes to you and says and explains their problems, and you say this is what you need, you couldn't do it for them.
Yeah, then you'd have to refer them to somebody who'll do that for them."
And he goes,
"Well, of course, we'll give them a completely different opinion."
Well, they'll just do it. I mean, I mean, you know, if you,
you become an order taker.
Yeah,
you know, just drive up. You know, welcome to my law firm. May I take your order, please?
Well, I mean, the best example is if you get, you think you got a crummy tire, and you go in a tire place, and he goes, "Yeah, you got a crummy tire. That'll be $50." What do you mean? Why can't you just sell me a tire? I can't sell it to you because it says that I'm, my opinion is influenced by the fact that I'm selling you the tire. So I'm charging you $50 for my opinion, and I'm going to write a little. I'll use the term prescription. You go across the street and you just walk in and say, "I need a tire." It's a two-step process. So anybody who gets a commission on a trade can't be trusted to to tell you whether it's whether it's a good idea or not, because he's getting paid by the action. Now, if I charge you just for my expertise, that's okay, because that's a fiduciary. How screwed up is that?
It's totally screwed up, and you know. What kind of an idiot would think of those kinds of things, let alone try to make it, you know, encoded as
I'll tell you, it's a 27 to 35-year-old, probably male, sitting there in a bureaucratic office thinking the next thing to do to put the screws to somebody. I'll ask you a real stupid question.
Well, it requires an outlook that everybody in your business is trying to screw somebody. So if you want to say, hey, it's a regulated business and we require transparency with what your fees are and how they're derived. Okay,
I want that too. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, no problem with that. The real issue is that they're just assuming they're just coming up with the dumb solution. If they think there's a problem, okay, let's define the problem. But just because we've defined a problem doesn't mean we have to come up with the stupidest solution possible.
Well, I can't.
Or apparently, it does.
I can't be on. I'm a guy on LinkedIn, so I get people, sometimes from college or high school, that'll find me. But I can't. I don't ever put anything on there because we would have to monitor that. I don't know what makes me so special. Same thing.
You don't write articles or anything like that that post on LinkedIn.
No. But if I did, Dan would have to track all that stuff. Even if it had nothing to do. This is the part that's even screwed up. If I were to start being, it's got to be the world's worst one. If I was going to start to, hey, business is bad, which it isn't, start to be a bartender on Saturday night, and I didn't let FINRA know about it, that's a huge screw up for both me and Dan, who's my regulator. There's nothing to do with my business. Now, why? Why do they need to know this? If somebody were to say, I went over to Kevin's house and three of us were painting the place and he gave us $100 a piece for a Saturday to help him paint, and I don't tell him that, I'm in violation.
Yeah.
Why?
Now,
why?
If you didn't disclose that you went to work for somebody whose stock you trade.
Yeah, oh, that's a big difference, sure.
That's a big difference. You know, again, all we need is disclosure. And if they really, really, you know, I don't know. Let's not sit here and agree on how stupid regulations can be.
But the thing is, you have nothing. There's a momentum to it. You have nothing to do all day. For instance, if you say you have to track emails to clients, okay, fine. Then somebody's going to sit there. Some moron is going to sit there and go, wait a minute, Jesus, this time guy, he doesn't always communicate to clients by emails. Sometimes he like talks to them. Okay, well, now, that's a problem. Do we want them to have to tape every line? Some firms do that because they think that that's needed because it's a little unclear. Does he have to tape every line when he talks to somebody? Well, what if he takes Kevin's a client and they go out and have a beer? Do you have to tape that conversation? I mean, it's just one thing to the other. Because once you define that if I communicate with you by email, it all has to be, you know, essentially logged and kept. Oh, then clearly, if that's correct, me talking to you driving home it can't be correct, right? How could it be? Because I'm not logging what I said to you on the way home. I mean, it depends on your mentality.
I'm pretty sure you're going to jail.
I mean, but my saying is it depends on your bureaucratic mind. Remember the what was a Star Trek episode where McCoy said, the bureaucratic mind has been a constant through the millennial or something, through the ages, or something like that. S&P futures up 6, NASDAQ futures up 5.25. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures up 7. NASDAQ futures up 775. It's after a huge turnaround in the market yesterday. The Qs, which is the NASDAQ 100 ETF, I think they were down 10 and finished up 13. It was an amazing turnaround as everybody decided between the CPI number and the debate or something that everything is okay. I don't know what exactly the sentiment was, but NVIDIA came flying back. It had been down and was up like, you know, $7 or $8, which it, you know, what is it, 24 billion shares outstanding? That's kind of a lot of money in terms of market value. So they made back a lot of what they were down. Dow futures are up 60. Individual stocks in the Dow, Caterpillar up $1.99. Goldman Sachs, which has been getting clobbered, up 232. And Salesforce up 243. Other than that, not a whole lot going on. Meta's up 211. Google up $1.48. That's, you know, it's just kind of bullish this morning, which we were down last night as we faded back a little bit after yesterday's rally, but now we're right back up again. DAX up 205, 1.1%. FTSE up 62.8%. CAC around up 59.8%. Over in Asia, Nikkei is up $1,200. Now these guys have been getting clobbered. That's 3.4%. 36,833. Hang Seng up 131.8%. 17,240. Shanghai, however, is still down 5. 27.17. And mainland China markets are just in a world of hurt. Yesterday, Dow was up 124, which doesn't tell the tale. It was down, Greg, 630 at one point. Came back at like a 750-point rally off the bottom. S&P 500 up 58. But here's the big one. NASDAQ up 369, 2.2%. Huge rally. Bonds up 1 basis point, 3.67. One up 2 basis points, 2.12. Japan up 1 basis point, 0.86. Oil. Oil's been, it's up $1.20, but still under 70. 68.51. Brent up $1.13, 71.74. Natural gas up a penny, 228. Arbob up 2 cents, 192. Gold up 220, 25.44. Hanging pretty steady in his mid-2500 range. Silver up 15 cents, 29.08. Copper up 7 cents, 421. Foreign exchange, 110 on the pound, where it has been. I'm sorry, 110 on the euro, 130 on the pound. Pretty much holding steady. Crypto up 498, 58,080. It was down, I think at one point yesterday, the day before, down like 3,000 to 55, and now it's back up to 58. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, everyone. 6:36 here in Chicago. We've got 64 degrees, mostly clear today, warm, sunny. High of 81. Phoenix, 84 right now. High of 107 today. Lots of sunshine. Again, caution advised if you're outside. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 17 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 42 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 31 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 24 minutes. And Stevenson, 294 to the Ryan, is 32 minutes. MLB, Guardians beat the White Sox. That was at Comiskey. That was 6-4. Rangers lose at Diamondbacks, 4-14. And Cubs lose at Dodgers, like you guys mentioned, 8-10. So I got, Chief. Back to you.
Well, I have a question for you. A market question from a couple of my clients. Actually, not clients. People that would be clients, I'll say. One of the guys calls me, and he lives in South Carolina. I won't hold that against him. Evidently, there's a spot
there.
Let's
go play golf.
Yeah, well, that's what he does. And so,
yes.
And
field trip.
This is the guy who's, I don't know if he's married or he's not. But he's, you know, got a girlfriend, whether they're officially married or not. They look for a house, you know, and at some point they're going to have a family. They got a dog. So the real estate lady showed him his house, and he goes, "What's that in the back?" He goes, "She goes, well, that's the alligator pond."
Yeah.
And he goes, "Is there an alligator?" "Well, there wouldn't be an alligator pond if there wasn't." He's like, "I don't want any part of an alligator on my property."
Alligator pond.
Yeah. Anyway,
watch out.
There's a place there where all this real high-end housing is going up. And when you have the high-end housing, for those that, a lot of times when you do your roofs, all your channels, your roof channels are all copper.
I'd say the listeners are familiar with high-end housing.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying.
Bingo.
You use a lot of copper. So he's an inquisitive fellow, and he drops in, and the guy's telling him they buy copper in the sheets, and then they form it, right? Says he's paying, I think, $9 per copper, per pound, and he says it goes up constantly. Now, what that means, and whether you know, you give him the, it goes up constantly. Now, why is the spot or the future price of 421, and it's been sticking right here, according to this guy, doesn't seem to be going up as fast as the spot price.
Interesting.
Does that mean?
Interesting. I mean, if you look at recently, call it 3 months, copper and their companies and I don't know, like places like Southern Copper have been going down recently.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look over the course of, call it 5 years, like COVID and before, those stocks, and it's maybe 2 to 3 times higher. So,
like Freeport's always the one we would trade, but now since they bought the gold company, they're not pure copper anymore.
Right. Southern, I think Southern is a decent.
But I mean, is this, in other words, if
from
you
what I've seen in copper, at least more recently, is the same as in the stocks, you know, call it $4.06 to $4. And
yeah,
the copper price has actually been calling, I would say, back down to where it was maybe 8 months ago. So there was a huge run up from, and when I say huge, I don't mean, well, yeah, four to five. So,
well, it's, you know, 20%. That's
20%.
A lot.
Yeah, in
25%.
Call it since March, and now we're back down. So I'd imagine his problems might be closer to the end than.
But just in general, you can't walk into Home Depot and see the price of 2x4s go up 20% and run to the futures market and buy lumber. I mean, just there's not always a connection.
No, not really.
That's what I thought. Hey, make sure you tweet out that thing about the hospitalization stuff, will you? The tweet where how much money pays for insurance, a company pays for insurance in 1990 or whatever.
Does everyone know what you're talking about?
Yeah, because I talked about it yesterday.
Yesterday, okay.
And I tweeted it out, and I said you were going to tweet it out.
Yeah, I can tweet that out. That was, it's just more evidence of kind of what you guys have been talking about.
Kevin, did you, I don't know if you heard that part yesterday where, I should dig it up here.
Oh, we were talking about copper.
Well, I mean, I jump from one to the other. You know, we get to do that.
Yeah, randomly too. You know, we keep listeners on their toes.
Well, I mean, I mentioned yesterday that, you know, we talked about the CPI a little bit, and then you have this chart here, where, you know, it says from 1999 to 2023, the cost of insurance for people has gone up essentially 4 times. And if CPI has it up like 1.5 times. And this is the kind of stuff that we do talk about in this chart you have here. Plus, Russell said this guy is very, very legit. This Charlie Bolello.
Yeah, good stuff on there. Give me a second here, and I'll pull up Stocks and Jocks Twitter.
You heard that part, Kevin. I mean, actually, I thought it was pretty good because when I did the calculation a few years ago, I had it up like 3.5 times through to 220, or 3 times up to 2020. So it's going up again. So, but, and what would you say if we were going to be rigorous and could compare a 1999 insurance that somebody gets from their company versus today?
Yeah, we just retweeted it. So if anybody's looking on X, we did it. And then the Twitter handle that originally put together the chart was Charlie, Charlie, Bolello. It's Billello.
And I'm going to say, Kevin, that most of the packages are not as good as they were in 1999. They probably have a little higher deductible, a little more copay. But, you know, it's hard to put that. In other words, I'm thinking it's even worse than the numbers show.
Oh, A lot has changed over the, and I can't pinpoint the date when we started doing it, but the idea of insurance was originally to spread the pain on big dollar items, so that people didn't go broke when they had some kind of a healthcare catastrophe or a healthcare event. And what do we do now? We try to have insurance cover everything. Your routine doctor visits, your garden variety prescriptions, etc. All of that. So what have we done? Well, we put a floor down on the cost of healthcare. We put a floor down to what they negotiate, and it never goes lower. And we put we're all paying for our health care. We're just paying for it, check paycheck by paycheck or month by month, depending on your arrangement. We're not getting value for it. It's not a competitive market. If you go back to the early 2000s, the Safeway stores had an insurance plan that worked like this. The first $1,000 of any expenditures were 100% covered by your insurance plan. The next $1,000 were 0% covered by your insurance plan. And then after that, it kicked into a more traditional insurance arrangement with copays. So for routine health care, people were very, very consumer conscious. They shopped like crazy during that first $1,000 because they didn't want to use it all up. They didn't want to blow it. But once they got into that second $1,000, if you thought they shopped really hard the first time, they were shopping really, really hard the second time when it was coming out of their pocket. And so in the area around where Safeway's corporate offices were, which I think was Minneapolis, the cost of any routine health care was lower than it was anywhere else in the country.
Because really?
You had this large employer putting market discipline into healthcare. We don't do that for the routine stuff, let alone the abominable stuff like, what are we going to charge for a cancer drug and, $1,000 a dose or something like that. Forget that. Just take, there's no market to how patent law affects the markets. There's no discipline there. But just thinking of the routine stuff. Well, gee, no wonder it's so damned expensive. We violate everything that we understand about how prices can be controlled by the market.
I think the one of the biggest, sure as hell not disagreeing, one of the biggest changes is the multiple step pricing that these hospitals negotiate with people. I can remember how long ago this was. I can remember where people would actually pay their bill and then they would file the insurance claim rather than having the hospital having to play patty cakes with the insurance company and have the two or three different price. And the person I was talking about, CW, he owned a manufacturing facility in Indiana, and they self-insured everything. I think they got, I don't know if they got like a $50,000 deductible or something from Lloyd's of London or somebody in case somebody had a premature baby or something, or in case somebody got cancer. They just paid everything else just straight out, and they ended up saving a real lot of money. You can't do that now because you don't have the network. The insurance you're not paying for insurance. You're paying for the network. You're paying for the different prices that they get that you can get, which is really, really screwed up and been shut down twice by Supreme Court. I mean, you talk about the Biden administration not paying attention to Supreme Court, the medical establishment doesn't pay any attention to them, do they?
No, it's like, oh crap, we lost. Well, never mind.
Yeah.
Just keep going along.
Well, I have I think the cost of, right now, can anybody? I mean, there's probably people that have a lot of dough, but is there an emergency room visit that's not several thousand dollars?
It were, but that wasn't always true. And what's funny about it is think of what most emergency room visits are. it's, you know, it's a broken arm, broken leg, you know.
Stitches,
yeah, that's all pretty routine. If you were to go to a direct primary care provider, they include that in their monthly fee, and they do it in the office.
I don't know if too many doctors anymore do anything in the office.
Well, that's the direct primary care model, though.
Yeah.
You know, that's why that works. And that's why that works for the subscribers. But, the point is, they understand that it doesn't have to cost you, $4,000 to get your arm, your broken forearm set and put in a cast.
No, another thing that is really creeping up, and it's the one in my term shockflation. There's a lady who lives in our building downstairs, and she gets a Frenchie, and she goes and gets another Frenchie.
She gets a what?
A little French bulldog.
Frenchie.
Okay. Frenchie. Not a boy toy French, tennis player. No. Of course, she pays up for these things because she's going month to month. And a nice lady, but, kind of going month to month. And I'm thinking, there's no way she even knows what a budget is. And there's not even a chance that she looked out to see what vet care costs today. Sure enough, the little guy, the puppy, I get the call. The puppy has trouble walking. He can't, his left legs don't work or something. So she takes him to some Northside vet. $2,000 into it, 5 prescriptions. Now he probably was there half hour, and so now they want him to see her to bring him to see some neuro something to do some test. $10,000.
So now it becomes, how much do you love your dog?
Yeah.
And are you a bad person if you don't spend this money?
Well, you see the commercials on here of the chiropractic place that I go to, and the guys are terrific, ChiroMed, and I go there maybe every couple of weeks, and they're trying to keep me together. I'll say, guess how much I pay.
No duct tape involved in that, Tom?
Yeah, guess how much I pay.
What do you pay?
$40.
I have no idea what a chiropractor costs.
$40, because I go every week or every 2 weeks. When Audrey takes little Maggie to the vet chiropractor, what do you suppose that is?
140. Okay.
So it's like 3.5 times what a human guy charges. What planet are we on here? Now you have vet insurance, which of course only is going to make it go even higher, right?
Wait a second. There's no Medicare for pets, though, is there?
No, but you can buy vet insurance easily.
So then what does it go down to?
Well, but you're paying, I think it's $100 a month for the insurance or something. And then who knows what risk. I don't know if there's copays or anything like that.
But don't you have to, don't you have a copay for the chiropractor?
It's just $40. I just pay him $40.
You pay him $40 for the entire thing?
Yeah. What's I'm only there? 10, 15 minutes.
Oh.
Yeah. And you're
does he bill
to
your insurance for anything?
No. If you put that on insurance.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Copay. If you put that on insurance with a copay, and maybe your copay is 20. Guess what the new price is? It's 60.
Yeah.
it's the copay plus what they were charging you all along.
And the idea
and you and Russell were talking about that. All you're doing tampering with the market is you're just adjusting prices upward.
Well, any kind of doctor's group now that has, maybe 2-3 people, they at least have to have 2 people that play patty cakes with insurance companies all day long. It would be so much more efficient. Just went in, got your service, wrote the guy a check for $50 or $100, and walked out.
Yeah, and that's what they do. That's what the direct primary care providers do. They don't take insurance, and you just pay them a monthly subscription fee, and you have basically unlimited access to the doctor whenever you need it. And it doesn't cover your major medical, obviously, because they can't do that in their own office. But you go get that catastrophic type of plan with a high deductible that's going to be there if you, if you have a heart attack or something like that. But otherwise, you are buying the service at a much lower price because they've taken all the overhead out of it.
All right. Well,
and a lot of doctors are moving that way. So there's kind of a steady movement towards it. And the reason is they hate dealing with the insurance companies, too.
So, well, they also are paying so much in malpractice that if they're not with a group, they're getting, they're forcing these guys to not be independent, just like anything else. I mean, you look around, and it's so sad when you have people, you know, the we had two creatures the other night sitting there on a debate stage, both opining on how they're going to give their left toe for the middle class, and the middle class has gotten screwed for the last 40 years, no matter who's been president. I mean, every time somebody says that, they should be, a water balloon should appear on their head, because there's nothing they're going to do for the middle class. I mean, they haven't forever. I mean, look at what they've done to small businesses. Name me, do you even know where there's an independent pharmacy? I can name maybe two.
You see, one here where I live.
But I think in Indiana or Michigan.
That's the only one I know of in the area.
I think in Michigan, I don't know how much you've screwed them, but in Illinois, they didn't pay them an independent pharmacy for a year and a half for their Medicaid.
Well, don't mistake Michigan for a well-run state.
Well, I'm saying, I don't know how bad it is there, but there's no way those guys can do the financing. If you have a, interestingly enough, of course, there aren't any generics around anymore, but the pharmacy used to make more money. John Dyer, who's been a guest a couple times, I should get him back. They make more money on like a $10 prescription than they do on a $100 one. Because they don't get hardly any edge on the real expensive ones. They get pretty serious margin in terms of percentage on the generic ones. But so they could be in a position of selling you a prescription for $110 that they paid $100 for, and they're not going to get paid the $100 from the state for like 18 months. That's enough to put anybody out of business.
Anybody who relies on, any business that relies on cash flow is therefore screwed.
Oh, yeah.
Because they'll say, well, what's your problem? You show a profit on your P&L. Well, yeah, I also have a very aged accounts receivable ledger, and so, yeah, so that's a real problem, and that's just a way, so when you start talking about that, do you have the large corporate the chains, the Walgreens and such, are they complaining about it? Sure, sort of.
Sort of, yeah.
You know, they know it's knocking out their most nimble competition. So, yeah, we don't like it, we don't love it, but on the other hand, it's kind of great.
Well, I listened to Trump talking the other day. Now, and everything is in the details, right? Everything is in the definition. And he came out and he said, my buddy, his new buddy, Elon Musk, said we should have a audit of all these federal agencies. Now, I don't know what Trump even thinks an audit is. I mean, he's a business guy, so he must know. But, I mean, my idea of an audit would be, and I don't know how you accomplish this in 4 years, because whoever gets in there new, something bad happens to them. 9/11, COVID, you name it, there's something that drives them off agenda. It's, or, you know, who knows what, if we're going to have a new president, something's going to happen in there, whether it's going to be a Taiwan thing, whether it's going to be something, whatever agenda you have, it seems like you can never really concentrate on it, because 4 years is pretty quick, and all it takes is one crisis, and you're done, right? I mean, I think you and I and the people on the show, and I think a lot of the listeners would agree, my idea of an audit was, hey, I've been talking on TV and radios and radio and in train stops for anything for 6 months about helping the middle class, and yet I know in my heart of hearts that 90% of what's screwing them is what we're doing to them. So my audit wouldn't just be how much money do you spend in your agency. I can tell that at a glance, right? I want to know what your agency's last 50 rules and regulations have done to the middle class and small business. Have they helped or hurt? And I'm going to say 90% of the time they've hurt, Kevin. That's my idea of an audit. The audit would be, are you idiots doing what I want you to do? I don't think that's what Trump meant or Musk meant either, do you? Or maybe they did.
Well, no, actually what I think they mean is we'll just cut loose all the unnecessary people. And which I'd be fine with doing that too, by the way. So,
well, I mean, what's unnecessary? You mean duplicative? I would say
duplicative, that they don't do anything productive. Musk's track record when he took over X was a whole bunch of people said they wouldn't come back to work, and he said, "You're fired." And everybody said, "How in the hell is he going to run the company with so few people?" And what is it, 2 years later? They're still okay. They're not flailing and not struggling with the ability to just operate. So whether you like what they do or not, there is not the issue. The issue is, have they been able to function with basically 50% of the staff? And the answer is yeah.
Well, you've essentially given everybody else.
There's a lot of that's bureaucracy. That's what poorly run companies are like. Well run companies and well run departments run as lean as they can. You have to have enough people to deliver your services and deliver them well, but a poorly run company, you go in, you just look around, and there's a whole lot of bloat, a whole lot of unnecessary.
Twitter fired close to 80% of their staff.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
So you got even more room if you want.
Well, I mean, but that's been the, I'm going to say, crummy management style from a distance forever. It can be really good management style. It could be other. What you see a lot of that is if it's a takeover from another firm. All right, cut 20% of the people. In some instances, you're cutting people that are bloat. In some instances, you're not. In a lot of instances, you're essentially lowering everybody else's pay by 20% because somebody's. I don't think many people, maybe it's government. I don't think many people show up to work and do nothing, Kevin. I mean, they're doing something.
Have you guys ever heard of how Netflix? Netflix does their hiring and firing.
No.
So he runs it, he calls it like a sports team. And if your manager isn't, they do a, would your manager fight for you test. So everybody who their managers kind of wouldn't step up for every quarter or half of a fiscal year, I don't know. But they say they're offered a generous severance package, and they just fire them.
Well, I mean, there's always going to be some people that are superfluous or maybe just not used. Maybe they have some talent and nobody listens to them.
What you really want to do is, are people engaged in value-added activities or not? And value is defined in the eyes of the customer. So, let's just say you're on a production line. What is value added and what's not? Well, value added is assembling, driving screws into something, cutting pieces, bending, all those things that you might do in a manufacturing process, putting parts together, all of that. That adds value. Does moving things around from place to place add value? No. So, in the lean world, you say, okay, well, we try and eliminate motion. Do inspections add value? The answer to that is no. They don't put a damn thing onto the product that enhances the value of that product when you deliver it to the customer. That mean you never have to do inspections? No, it doesn't mean that. Because sometimes if you've got flaws in your process, you damn well better be inspecting because you have to stop the bleeding. However, once you start fixing products, if you get into that Six Sigma world, and I don't know how much you know about this, Tom, but the benchmark for it is that your average is 3.4 mistakes or errors per million opportunities. So, and that's Motorola started pioneering this in the 1980s. So, when you get that efficient, the perfectly efficient, most companies aren't, then you are running lean. You're not inspecting everything because the people are doing the work right in the first place. You've built process that allows them to do it right in the first place, and they self-inspect.
Well,
that's a difference. So that's when I say bloat, there's a lot of bloat of people doing non-value-added things.
Well, I agree, and a lot of most of it's in hospitals. It's going to be in the ivory tower, not in the doctors.
It's absolutely going to be in the ivory tower, and to an extent, it's going to be elsewhere. Because my daughter doesn't drive, I take her when she has to have a blood draw for something. the last two times we've been in there, she's made appointments, and a half hour later, she gets called, even though there's not a lot of people sitting there in the waiting room, and it's for a 2 or 3 minute blood draw and send it off to the labs. I'd love to see what's going on there, because I don't think they quite get the concept of the appointment.
We'll talk about that more on Friday, Kevin, because that's a huge.
You got Lou on Friday.
Oh, that's right. We got Lou Friday next week. But at Pullman, I mean, they were big. After being in business 100 years, the people, the engineers, would actually set the inspection protocols based on how key the part was. They'd say this one has to be 12 inches by 15 inches plus or minus 10 thousandths or something, and then it would say right on there, inspect every 10th part or inspect every 5th part, depending on what it was. But if you ever had that thing, when you're putting all these parts together for an underside of a train car, if that thing ever got like a half inch out of whatever, the train car would literally be going down the track slightly sideways.
Right. So you're going to do an FMEA analysis, failure mode effects analysis, and you're going to say, how do I make sure this doesn't happen? Because if you're inspecting every 10th one, you're not going to catch every one that goes that's bad.
But
all that's going to tell you is, do I have a systematic problem that repeats itself?
If you're coming off the same machine, you're not. If the machine settings change to where you're screwed up, you're going to catch it every 10th one.
Yeah, because you have something that's doing it wrong every time.
Yeah, but I'm saying it's different.
But if you just have intermittent, people make mistakes, people do what it, if it's just intermittent failures in the process, you're counting on luck that every 10th one is going to hit the one that was wrong.
I always tell you about, because we've got to go to Dan here in a second, but I always tell you about my nephew's place, because he's he's the thumb on the pulse of the manufacturing thing here in Chicago. And their place, I don't know if their inspector retired or quit or died or something, I don't know what happened to the guy, but they were without an inspector for a while and really couldn't hire one. They ended up with, I'm going to say, 2 or 3 six-figure oopsies that they had to redo parts for someplace. So somehow or another, I mean, there's a choreography to this that, you're right, the people who do the stuff, matter of fact, they pulled me, you know what they would do for a part? It would go to the wood shop. And they would make the part exactly the right size in wood. So you could check your gauges on your machines by just using the wood template.
Yeah, you know what that's called?
A template?
Poke yoke. Oh. Poke yoke, idiot proofing it.
Well, duh.
That's process. That's good process. And I'll leave you with this thought. As Edwards Deming said, the late Edwards Deming said, a bad process will defeat a great employee every single time.
Oh, without a doubt. SPV's up 11. NASDAQ's up 20. Want to go right to Dan, Greg?
You guys got it.
Dan, we got it, bud.
I'm here.
How are you? So we're
good. How are you?
All right. We're just kind of going through the market move yesterday. We're going through some of the sports stuff. We're going through everybody on the debate stage talking about how they can help the middle class, and nobody's helped them in 40 years.
Yeah.
And what it would mean to actually help them in the regulatory part and everything, and do either of these people get what it would take to turn that bus around? Or even, I think, let's put it this way, let's be more charitable. What in the process, in a four-year term, with usually some crisis that always comes up, and not very many people, except Clinton, basically got to go through 4 years. Well, he had the ship that got blew up and a few other things, so it wasn't exactly a cakewalk for him either. Do you get knocked off your game so much that you can never even accomplish the things you want to accomplish? And what's going to happen for the market, for these companies that are, some are expensive? What's going to happen with this deficit that, I don't care who it is, one of them, they're both going to have to address it, because they both administrations have blown the deficit up in the last two or the last eight. How does anybody really stop that without sending people checks? It seems like an amazing undertaking here, Jim, Dan, and how it applies to the markets and fixed income, and can they do it without interest rates blowing to 10 because they're borrowing money, more and more money? I mean, pick one of those and solve it for us.
Yeah, sure. A little bit of each. So in terms of what can be done going forward, I think one of the things that was brought up that's really important is, obviously the concern about inflation. And the inflation number, the CPI number that came out the other day, you know, is slightly higher than expected. But really what's more important than inflation itself are price levels. So for anybody who goes to the grocery store, you know that price levels are still quite high. So I think the challenge for middle class, and actually for pretty much everybody, is just getting used to these higher prices. So that's probably the place that the work needs to happen, is you know, getting some getting some disinflation, getting some price declines. If we continue the way we are, if we see 25 basis point cut next week, which is what I think is likely, then I think we're going to see this gradual move, you know, a gradual disinflation. So, and that's what we need. We don't need anything to happen very quickly. We don't certainly don't need anything that's going to continue to put money in the system, as you mentioned. So even a little bit of an increase in corporate taxes would be good. And so these are some of the things that I think we need to pay attention to. The mistakes that have happened over the last eight years have had a lot to do with money, so much money coming into the system, and that's what's caused inflation.
Well, how are you going to get any kind of disinflation, meaning prices going down, when all you're trying to do is get from 3% to 2% on a lied upon number? Let's say the number wasn't even lied upon.
It's going to take some time. We have to be patient with it. So the, you know, as we've talked before, it really depends on what statistics you're looking at in terms of price declines, in terms of, you know, inflation coming down. And I don't think, I would think most of the average consumers will say we really haven't seen a whole lot of drop in prices. I mean, if you're dealing with contractors, for example, you know, you're doing work on your house. If you're doing, as you guys were mentioning earlier, medical costs being high. If you've hired a lawyer or have any lawyer friends, charging quite a bit. So we haven't seen any price stability. And how that happens is through competition, right? So that's how our, you know, it is one of the things that I think Harris mentioned, whether or not hopefully it will be something she follows through on, is the focus on small businesses, like our businesses, Tom. So the easier access to money, you know, the opportunity to, you know, maybe provide some support to smaller businesses who will help with that challenge. So we need, you know, we need to go away from the move towards the big seven and maybe have others come in that can offer something else, other companies, small companies, but other companies that can offer, you know, better service, as you guys were talking earlier, better pricing, more competitive pricing. And so I think that's what will happen. That's what needs to happen in order to start seeing prices decline.
Well, why? I mean, I guess just by definition, we have a Mike Murphy's piled in here a little bit this morning as well, and he's a we want to talk just a hair on your stuff, Dan, with what's going on in the military and other things. But how do you, just by definition, and Mike was an economist like me at Notre Dame, how do you even address the price level if all you're trying to do is keep the price increases down to 2% and failing at that? How does that even make an attempt at price level?
It's just like I said, I think the price level is going to be a function of who's running the show. So if you only have X number of, it's going to be access to new jobs, it's going to be access to new businesses coming in to the market. And if you only have so like three or four, let's say, large banks that are really aren't paying, you know, if you think of even my bank, Bank of America, doesn't pay anything on your checking account.
How are they getting away with that still?
Well, that's my point, is that when you get to a point where you have only, you know, the larger players are controlling the market, if you will. So the larger banks control the, you know, the consumer financing. They control where people put their money. Well, if you you have to have choices as a consumer. You have to have choices of where to go. And so all of a sudden now you have Interactive Brokers who's, you know, still paying close to 5% on cash. So it's the ability to have new companies and new talent and new businesses come into the picture and not being squeezed out the way they have over the last year, over the last two, you know, 8 years.
We'll say one more thing, and then we'll have Mike gonna comment on the defense part of the of the budget thing. That wasn't even talked about the other night on the debate. But I guess what I'm hearing you say, Dan, and by the way, you don't know it, but you're agreeing with me, that Carl's is of the opinion, and a couple other people on the show are of the opinion that that'll never work. You need some sort of a money supply pullout. You need the market down 30%, and these prices just absolutely have to go down. They blew up 40%, and now they got to come down 20%.
That would happen if we have a little bit of an increase in corporate taxes. It doesn't have to be a big increase, but just a little bit of an increase would be a start.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is I think I don't know that Carl's wrong, but I think it's worth a try. What you and I want to do, which would be to a little more competition means people's salaries might go up a little bit. That somehow we may never get the 40% covered, but my goal would be in the next 5 years to have inflation at 2% and the average paycheck up 3.5%. Not just because we're paying people more for nothing, but they're actually doing stuff. We're doing more manufacturing here. We're doing things that make people more efficient. We're doing those kinds of things. It's worth a try, I think. I don't know. And yesterday I asked Russell, what do you think the chances of that being success? And he was like 50-50. But still worth a shot. You know, I don't know how else you necessarily do it. But even simple stuff that you and I mean, you know, we're pretty good at math, you and I. I mean, I was saying,
I think that the important thing is to have this disinflation happen in a slow, like gradually. If it happens very suddenly, then we're going to be in a shock.
I'm with you. But when does it ever happen? Gradually. I was talking yesterday.
Well, you know, during the Greenspan years, we had a gradual increase in rates and a gradual decline in rates, and that's sort of what we've been seeing here. Yeah. So I think I might be a little more optimistic that 25 basis points next week is a good way to start, and not to like go to 50, not to have any extreme moves that are going to shock the market. Now, some of the benefits that I think all the listeners would understand is we've seen rates come down quite a bit over the last few weeks. We've seen, I mean, the bond market is on fire. We've had a very good few weeks here, especially relative to equities. But with rates coming down, that also means mortgage rates are coming down. So does that necessarily mean that home prices will go up? Not necessarily. It doesn't equate to that.
But when they went up, the prices didn't go down. So it's not acting like it's supposed to. So it could
right, exactly.
All right, my quick question. When you have this contract, was it Boeing or somebody, yeah, some huge place just got a big contract? Now, I don't know. I think going out, it's 4 years or five. Let's say five, and I don't know how many years they've spent without an increase. So if I think the increase is going to be 25% over the 4 or 5 years. Now, if they haven't had an increase in 2 years, they're not close to being even, Dan. With what you and I think the inflation is for the 3 years before and the 5 years going forward, they're not even close. Are they?
Yeah, true.
Hey, Mike, are you with us?
Yes, Tom.
How about piling in and what wasn't asked? And Dan, feel free to hang, you know, absolutely hang, but opine in on this. What is the status? We've been talking a lot on the show. What pieces of the budget can you fix? And it, you know, one of the things was you can fix, if you wanted to, you could fix Social Security pretty quick. It's not that far off. You know, another year higher and maybe 1% more being paid in, and you pretty much fixed it. Medical stuff, they're only covering 40% of what they're spending. So that's a disaster. There was no question really the other night, Mike. What about the military budget? And a real lot of that budget is pensions and stuff to people, right? That's not going to go away. How much of the military budget is actually, you know, I'll say discretionary, but a lot of it just, you know, we got to have this, we got to buy, you know, gas for the ships, and we got to do this and the other. How is that kind of broken down? Is there any room in there for anything, or how does that even work? It wasn't even addressed.
Tom, I'm not sure how much of it. I think it's used to be about 50% was the pensions and all that, because they always want to cut the pensions. But they haven't talked about really many substantive issues. It's basically been a pack of lies on both sides, but, you know, that's beside the point. and I've got to get ready for work, so I'm gonna.
I'm just wondering because we're trying to find some solutions here. I don't see a whole lot of give on the defense side of the budget. Do you? I mean, we got. If anything, it's probably going to go up with the stuff we've been.
Yeah, no, there's no give on the defense side, and you're right; it should go up. But you know, they've got to rein in the other spending first. The debt, the interest on the debt is what's going to kill us, at least for the time being.
Yeah, I mean, when they were paying 12% and 14%, which we all remember. The debt wasn't anywhere near as much. I mean, I'll go back to what the number was, but I'll find it here. But the total debt, and now, a 1% change in the interest rate is, what, $30 billion a year or something? That's like a lot of money. Right? Well, no, it's $35 trillion. So 1% is $300 billion, right? 1% of $35 trillion? Am I math right? I think it is. We didn't used to... Mike, I don't recall in school we used the trillions too much, did we, up on the blackboard? And nobody knew.
I don't remember that at all.
Can you imagine a professor back in our day putting like a number up there, a trillion? We all go, what the hell is a trillion? if you put a billion up there, we were kind of shocked, like, hey, who's got a billion? I don't know. The young kids know what a trillion means? I don't.
I don't think anybody does.
Well, next week, Kevin will be on Wednesday and Friday, so we'll talk more sports. Hopefully the Irish will win by then, but we'll talk some of that. Plus, I want your opinion on how this NIL stuff is affecting the coaching. So you have a time to think about that one.
All right.
Dan, so it doesn't look like Mike thinks there's a whole lot of give in the defense side. I think there probably isn't. So that leaves
probably
us with...
Not. Yeah, probably not. I think that's going to be a steady, that's going to be continue to be an issue going forward. One thing I want to mention is that I've heard from a number of clients and people that are wondering what, in terms of rates coming down. And to maybe to go back to the point about the deficit, lower rates are going to also be helpful there. So it's going to be helpful across the board. That'll it doesn't necessarily bring down, it does bring down the cost of capital, and that means for government, for corporations and for individuals. So again, this gradual decline in rates that we're seeing is probably the best of all worlds for, certainly for a bond person like me, but it's the best of all worlds for anybody holding debt. So it's very, very positive. I see that continuing, in the future, and I do think we're gonna see a gradual move. It isn't gonna be a sudden move, and it shouldn't be a sudden move. But the decline in rates will be one of the solutions, I think, to some of the deficit issues, to some of the budget issues. Over time, I think we're gonna fare well. And to the listeners, this is a fantastic time to be in bonds. So as rates come down, that doesn't mean you sell your bonds and go back into stocks. That means you continue to hold your bonds because the price of your bonds is actually going up. So as I've mentioned, we've had a fantastic couple of weeks. This is going to continue. This is going to be the direction, especially with short-term rates. One thing that's happened over the past few weeks is we've had the yield curve flatten out. And what that means is that the yield on a two-year right now is at about 3.7%, whereas the yield on the longer-dated maturities is close to 4%. So that's what we would consider positive slope, and that is generally a good thing. And that's this inversion, as we call it, a reinversion or disinversion, has actually been a good thing. Short rates are still very high. So for a one-year, 1 month T-bill, you're still getting 5.1%, and that's very attractive. So the environment that we're coming into of declining rates is not only going to be good as an investor, but it will be good for the government, corporations and individuals as a whole.
How does the Fed, when you talk about lowering rates, you're talking about adding money to the pool, correct?
To a certain degree, but if it's done gradually over time, I think it's the timing of it that makes the most sense, and actually the amount of the decline. So there was, interestingly, the other day we were seeing the shift from 50 basis points to 25 when the CPI number came in, the inflation number came in stronger than expected. but it's actually a very positive thing that we're going to only stick to 25 next week, and I'm pretty confident that's the way the market is pricing it.
Okay, but if we they've added to the money supply the last 5 months.
Yes.
Which, now what you're saying is if you add 1% and the growth is 3, you are dragging inflation down by 2.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which would be but negative 2, not positive 2, right?
Right.
So right now they're adding to the money supply to get interest rates down, and they're also trying to fight inflation. That's a real tricky game because your risk is that the growth doesn't increase and all you do is pile on the inflation again. It gets worse instead of better. I mean, I don't see where we're getting this 3% growth. I'd love to see it. But through regulation, through other stuff, I don't know what it is. But I think a lot of places got real busy after the COVID and we brought some stuff back from overseas. I don't see that falling apart, Dan, but I don't see it. We're down to like almost like a regular level. We're not in a growth level anywhere that I can see in this area. Now, other areas maybe. But I don't know that. I mean,
there's a slowdown, Chief, but it's a good thing that we're having a slowdown like this. As I'm saying, that this gradual slowdown, I don't anticipate that we're going to see growth. We're in the phase of the cycle now where we have a slowdown. We're in the, you know, we're heading towards not necessarily a trough, but we've turned the corner. If it happens gradually the way it has been happening, it's a good thing. So we have time to readjust. But I do agree with you that the looking at the growth, I think we're past our fastest growth. You know, I think if you're looking at certain sectors, I think technology still has, as much as I'm not a fan of tech stocks right now, I think technology still has room to run in terms of growth opportunities. There's the other growth opportunities, you know, rather than looking at just the large companies that trade on the markets, think about small companies. So we've seen more smaller businesses open since the pandemic. We've seen more funding now going towards opening small businesses. I think that's the key to our economy. That's what America's been about from the very beginning. It's been about the small business owner. You know, 67% of our GDP comes from small businesses. It's not just the larger businesses. So the focus, again, I think to keep us on a good track would be to continue to support small businesses and small business owners and guys like us.
I'm absolutely on your side, but I keep poking because I want to get every inch of knowledge out of you. I have a client, a good friend and client, who is in, you know, I don't ask him what he does all the time, Dan, I'm not that nosy. Plus, if it's not on my, it's on a need-to-know basis, and I don't need to know, one of those kinds of things. And but I know he does a lot of, they do a lot of big building, like, you know, apartment buildings and stuff. And he and his buddies now are almost at a point now where they want designs in the apartment building. I'm talking on a major street in Chicago. They want designs in the residential building. And we're not talking about towers. I mean, but where they can have people living essentially on the ground floor, not where people can walk in off the street and steal their stuff, because you can't sell that retail anymore. There is none. It's just gone. And so when people talk the other night about, you know, resurrecting this. Dan, it's like calling up Pullman now for a railroad car and getting they're answering the phone at Walmart. It's right. Gone. I mean, I don't know that. You know, there's a. I'd love your opinion on this because I'm out there. But I'd love Greg's opinion on this too. There's somewhat of a difference between stuff that just kind of goes down for a while, and you can pick it back up. And I'll use an example. And again, I use an example that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, which is typical me. On the north side, where I live now in Lincoln Park, the area got, I'm going to say, somewhat crummy for a long period of time. And all of a sudden it was, I'll use the term gentrified. All of a sudden, you know, the uppies are like cockroaches. They take over neighborhoods, right?
Absolutely.
But, you know, it was relatively easy to do because the buildings were still there. You can remodel a house. You can take the 100-year house and gut it and make it like a new house. The stand up storefront 6 months from now can be a bar or it can be a nice dress shop for ladies or shoe shop or whatever. it doesn't take much. And yet, like when Martin Luther King died, we had the riots here in Chicago, a huge stretch over like in Ogden and Roosevelt was all burned out and it's flattened. Dan, it's still flat. I mean, once it's gone, I don't know how you, just by talking words and throwing stuff out there like was the other night, I don't know how you start it back up again. As much as I love the place and would love to build railroad cars, I mean, I like that almost as much as I do trade in the market. If a mayor or a governor said to me, here's $1 billion, start one up, how the hell do you even do it? Who do I even call? Those people are dead or they're getting other jobs.
Right.
I think we've, in some places, we've gone so far that even though Americans are the most, you know, I think able to do, to make, you know, to make wine out of water just about almost like a god when it comes to manufacturing stuff. When you start from zero and when you lose that skill set, it's a lot harder than people talk about on TV.
Yeah, no, I know. I mean, I guess first of all, we're talking about politicians that are making these.
But you even
know,
you and I, it's not.
I agree. No, I agree with you that it's that, you know. I mean, the theory makes a lot of sense, but I think the point that you're getting to, or something that I would take, you know, to go a step further, what's happened with the shift in demographics is that a lot of the baby boomers who have that experience have stepped out of the market. They've yep. retired. They've moved into other areas, you know, they're, and it has left a void in terms of people who can train, who can bring their knowledge base to say manufacturing or to even other sectors. So there's that would be, I think, one of the biggest challenges that we face going forward is just having the people who have the experience to make this transition that we're talking about, because I know that in a number of industries, they're trying to hold on to talent that's getting older. I think that's still happening in the engineering world, where we don't have a replacement. And a lot of the people who are coming into middle management don't have the skills to be able to make the transition and to be able to see growth again and to be able to revitalize and all of that. So I would say that would be our biggest challenge going forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's real hard to start something from scratch.
Yeah,
I think you and I can be more than capable. If we see all these people moving back in and we see a storefront going, hey, these people don't have a bar. There is a place. I mean, I think in 6 months or 4 months, you and I can have the place. We know what a bar looks like, but I'm not so sure if it's just an empty lot. It's a different challenge, isn't it?
It is a big challenge. And I have a couple conferences coming up that I'm attending that are smaller cap conferences, and there's a big push, you know, with private equity and with people putting money. And I do think private equity will continue to help support, and even private credit will help support some of this growth that we're talking about. But there's a big push to try to you know, again, we're talking about needing somebody who can get in that has the ideas, that has the talent, and that has the resources or access to the resources. So you want to have some faith in our system that we do have investors out there that are still looking for good opportunities and that can see value in, you know, whether it be in real estate in Chicago or whether it be in you know, the tech field or biotech or solar or some other area, and put the money behind this to expand the growth. The visionaries to do this, I think that's where we have the challenge, getting the people in there that actually can lay it out and follow it through. I agree with you, there are a lot of people that have a lot of great ideas, but it's actually the execution of those ideas that becomes the challenge.
Well, how much of an issue is we always talk about the antitrust stuff. I mean, I have a lot of clients, you know, not going to say what nationality, but a lot of them are doctors. And the thing about doctors is they all hear about all these companies that people have really good ideas in the medical stuff. Not always a drug, could be a medical device, could be anything. Even really simple. I have a buddy who somebody invented. Talk about something simple, Dan. It's a it looks like a dish mat, of all things, and in surgery, you can put it on the whatever you cover people up on when you're operating on them. I mean, what is that? What is that thing they throw over you when you're operating? Whatever.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah.
But you can put this thing, lay it down on, you know, where the guy's thigh is or something, and all your utensils, it has a coating on it where they'll stick there and not drop on the floor. And all you do is put them there. So you almost don't need the nurse handing you the scalpel back and forth. You can put it there and it'll stay. And it's simple. It's ingenious. Every doctor goes, I'd love to have one of those. These guys cannot get into a hospital without who are these guys? We don't know them. They're not Merck. They're not Abbott Labs. They're not. They cannot get in the door. I mean, they have a lot of like dentists and people that have bought the stuff individually, but they can't even get. Who are these guys? You know, it's almost like Chicago. We don't want nobody sent. I mean, some of these guys have been involved in some of these companies, and they all buy a boatload of this, you know, the small stocks. And I've actually gone to some of the companies, not some, a couple, and I, you know, met these guys, and the stuff makes a whole lot of sense, Dan. They can't get anywhere. One guy sold his marketing rights to was it Merck or somebody who had a procedure, just a competing device. They never sold one. The cartel. Well, I don't see how you and I could run for God knows what. We could run for the deity, and we can talk all we want on TV. Unless we bust that up, we can't have Chicago with 15 medical device companies downtown, because they can't sell one. It's that bad. And I don't know how you talk about the high tech stuff. If every single time somebody does something decent, Microsoft or Google buys them or puts them out of business, that's not, we're not getting there, bud, by doing any of that.
I'm thinking of a few of the companies, you know, because we do a lot of research on small companies, and one thing that I still put at the top of the list when we're looking is the management team. So a management team that can execute, and management team that has a good strategy. And I'm thinking of a medical device company in Boston that we had purchased. We had done our research on the company. They make devices for robotic surgery, and they were very smart about how they connected. They connected through the universities, through the medical centers in Boston, and that's been a steady flow of business for them, and that's been a way that they've been able to take some market share in what would be dominated by places like Abbott and some of the larger companies. So I think it's a vision and it's a plan, and there has to be something that is this. There has to be some special sauce, if you will. It has to be, whether it be price better or better quality, or, you know, provide something in the product that's going to be different. A lot of, I would say that the majority of organizations want to see small businesses flourish and want to see, you know, want to put money into small businesses. But I think the most important thing is to have a good management team.
I agree.
To have a good, and but, also to have a plan for how you're going to execute. And I, unfortunately, in the tech world, I see a lot of people with a lot of good ideas, but they don't necessarily know how to carry them through. You know, there's a lot of people now that want to do new apps, but when it's that competitive and when there are that many options, as an investor, we want to look for areas of the market that have barriers to entry, that involve certain skills, where there are, you know, the main thing is looking for an opportunity that has upside, but also has legs, that has a long-term focus, that isn't just looking to make the new thing that the current population is looking for. We're looking for a quick fix to something, so people are focused on that. And by the time they finish their business plan, technology has taken us into a new era. So,
right.
So that, you know, it's there's no question it's a challenge. But again, going back to the way we conduct research, we tend to like companies that are more in the basic industries. We tend to like, for long-term investments, we want to see a company that absolutely, and I keep saying this, but a good management team makes a huge difference. We want to see a company that treats their employees well. Retention of good talent is really important. We want to see a company that has a good mission statement, that you know, wants to keep employees. They want to treat, you know, that is so important. And as you guys were talking earlier, I caught the tail end of it. Some of the big companies, some of the big tech firms, and a few of my clients have been very honest with me about their experience, that they were treated extremely well by Amazon, and now today they don't receive the same, you know, they don't receive the same support that they did from management. They're thought of as being dispensable. you don't start an organization and hire people and let them know that they're dispensable. You want to have, in order to attract the right talent, you have to have the right benefits. You have to provide a culture and an environment that's strong. So all of that is so important. Those are the things we look at when we're out looking at new companies to invest in.
Well, Dan, you also, a lot of the places, I don't know, some of the places you've told us about are somewhat, I don't know, can I use the term regional? I mean, you the one firm you really liked in Florida was going to do a lot of the infrastructure stuff and asphalt and all those other kinds of things.
Yes.
And yeah. They can be, if you have the right team, which you found the right guys, and you've got, quote, your area, it's sort of not the same. They're not really going to compete. You're going to find another company like that, I think, in, Jackson, Wyoming. One's not going to compete with the other. I mean, you can't really right. get there unless, you know, you want to be like when Camel Bethesda started buying all the power companies around the rest of the country right back in the 20s when LA did it. But by and large, some of the small companies are there, and they're very good. It's sort of not the same with this national, oh, no, you can't buy. But, you know, why do you not expect Amazon, not expect, but see the pattern in Amazon forgets about their clients as time goes on? I mean, Sears did the same thing. They were the original Amazon, right?
Right, and also their employees.
Yeah.
They're not providing the support, the environment, the upside potential, the advancement, the benefits. They're not, they're getting a little cocky, if you will, in terms of their growth. And that I still goes back to our initial point. I think we still need to think of America the way it started, and small businesses and providing those opportunities. So somebody needs to carry through, when we're talking about the administration, yeah. The next administration needs to carry through with really providing that support.
Well, what do you think, if you're to list?
There's always going to be companies that fail. There's always, people, but I think we want to allow people to take a chance, right?
I do, too. What would you do if I wouldn't want to be up there, but if I was one of the dudes up on the, or people, since one's a lady now, on the dais, and I would say, let's call, if there was an audience, let's call Dan Janitas in the first row. He's a knowledgeable guy, or we wouldn't have invited him in. Hopefully he doesn't have a gun. what would be your top three issues? I'll lead off with this. I'll say my biggest concern over the last several years. Now, one of the things you have talked about, small businesses, and how good the management is. And by the way, I'm with you 100% on this. I don't know if you're Harry Houdini, if you can be paying 8-9% for capital when a big firm's getting it for 2 or 3, and those guys are getting it for less than inflation, because somehow or another, the Fed and the big banks have orchestrated it that way. Somehow, the plumbing company who's got already 5 trucks and wants the 6th truck shouldn't have to put a personal guarantee on that when he hasn't missed a payment in 30 years. I mean, Jeff Bezos isn't putting a personal guarantee on anything.
Right.
I mean, somehow we've got to even this playing field out. And if it was you and me, unless we had some really good banking relationship with some small bank, if we wanted to build the bar in the neighborhood that all has a bunch of people moving in, I don't think we can finance that in our credit card at 22%, can we? Would anybody give us the dough, and how much are we paying versus someone else?
Yeah, and actually you make a good point that I think I can use as an example. So one of the companies that we had invested in, we owned the bonds, it was called One Main Financial. And they had traditionally been a business that provided financing to consumers who were, didn't have, the strongest balance sheets or didn't have the most income. So that, I think they ended up just focusing on a very small segment of their business that actually has done very, very well. But a financial organization that would provide support to new businesses, that would do the kind of, it's basically what we do. We're interviewing companies, we're looking at new opportunities. And would provide it at a rate or in a manner that would allow the company to make it through that first challenge, to provide the financing to get them to the next point. So they just need investors to be able to step in and provide those opportunities and certainly to do it at a lower cost. that's part of the reason that private credit is becoming very, very, very popular again. Because the banks, I mean, it's a good thing that the bank standards have gotten strict. It's a good thing that, as you're saying, you'd have to pay more if you don't have the financial, you know, you don't have the operating history, you don't have the financial background to get the low rates. But now with private credit, there are companies that are coming into the market that are providing that credit at a lower rate to potential new businesses. And that is an area of growth in the financial industry in our business that I think is very has a lot of upside.
Well, but I just, you know, the criticism of me that I make of myself in the mirror is I immediately get myself embroiled in the detail. I mean, I would be the idiot running for president that would say I'm going to help the middle class, and the first thing I'm going to do is take apart, who were the two jamokes that came up with the banking bill, the huge banking bill after the 2008 that did nothing but screw up small people, not big people. Was it
Dodd-Frank?
Dodd-Frank. First thing I'm going to do is take Dodd-Frank and rip it in half and start over, because all that has done is screwed small people, which it has, in my opinion. Now, until you're willing to say something like that and actually do it, you can talk about helping the middle class all day long. It's like, you know, it's like talking about getting a hole in one and not playing golf. Well, you're never going to get there.
Yeah. No, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I'm just, you know, we're looking for solutions and ways that, you know, opportunities that can be provided to provide funding, financing, opportunities, and you know, you're right. In theory, like, you can talk all you want about doing it, but it actually, I think if there are companies like, I'm talking about one Main Financial as an example, but there are other companies that are providing service or, you know, there'd be a need to actually start a new business, to have a business that actually provides support. And maybe one thing that I've thought about that is working is a lot of these people, these guys who have left the tech industry, have a lot of talent. There are people who could be very helpful to people like you and me if we were in the situation of trying to grow our business, because they have the skill set to know how to attract, you know, new customers. They know how to market. They know how to, you know, get out on social media or whatever venues it's going to take. I mean, whatever paths it's going to take to make their business successful. So they have the talent. They don't necessarily have, you know, they don't realize it. But I think that talent is there, and being able to discover that talent that can help the business owner or the small business owner.
Well, I would agree. I mean, if we were gonna, I mean, fortunately at PTI we have two clearing relationships, and those guys essentially provide the back office stuff. Now IB is way more advanced in that than RBC, but for regular accounts, RBC has its advantages too. So we, as the client comes in, we kind of we'll talk through them what they're looking for, and we'll place them where we think it's best for them. Now, obviously, IB pays a bunch of money on cash balances, and on RBC, of course, being the good firm that we are, we go get around that, and we buy T-bills for everybody every Monday. So they end up probably maybe a little better, but it's a lot more work on our part. But, Dan, when you talk about these firms, and you, of course, you're always talking about the American way, which is, I'm with you. There's these firms that are essentially, I won't say the world, they're doing the job of the banks. Now, my question to you is, these guys have gotten so big, and all they want to do is make a whole bunch of money, and they, for themselves. I mean, I don't think the bank stocks have done all that well. They've done well this year, but when you have one of my guys, where I'm going with this, one of the guys you met, a couple of these dudes, from the Federal Reserve, they ended up putting the exchanges, the clearing piece, parts of the exchange, CME Clearing and OCC, now have direct lines to the Fed for money, because we have banks that are paying people no interest on deposits, charging fees.
Right.
They're not really giving loans. I mean, I don't know. Can you and I walk into Citigroup and get a car loan or a loan on our house? I doubt it. I mean, at our level, maybe we could. I mean, at Lakeside Bank, even they're a smaller bank here, and the bank PTI uses, and I've used them forever. I said, "Can you, do you guys even like do car loans?" The guy will give you one. I said, "That's not what I asked. Do you have somebody who does?" Come on, now we don't do that anymore. And well, anyway, the part of Dodd-Frank was that if somebody drops a big chunk of change in your bank, meaning money, you that all of a sudden you need more equity in the bank to accept that. Okay, so if one of the exchanges or the clearing corps happen to have like $500 million of the way, you know, they had a margin calls or whatever, their you know, their money demands go up and down by the day, you know that. And so it got to the point where if they dropped it off at Citigroup or J.P. Morgan, Jamie Dimon wanted to know personally if that was coming in because he wanted to reject it because it might leave the next day. Well, okay, so we have a bank with all the favorable stuff they get from the government, and you can't deposit money there, and they won't give you a loan. What the hell are they for?
Right. No, I agree. I think there was a huge, I don't know what the word, I don't want to say necessarily overreaction, but a huge reaction to what happened in, you know, in 07, 08, 09, where the banks were, and they were bailed out. You're right. I mean, they were given the resources. But the, you know, we think about that as being, it's for a lot of people, that's a long time ago, right? And for young people especially, they may not have really experienced, you know, living in a part of the country, like I was in Florida during the time when that hit, and it was pretty bad. It affected, you know, it affected the local economy in a pretty severe way. So the I guess, remembering what things were like back then, and for you and I, we can go all the way back to 87 to remember what things were like. And I think that, you know, that it's really important to know that there are, you know, you learn, I think, from those times. You learn the most from those times, and we haven't had a period like that in a long time. So we're going to go through something like that again. That is definitely going to happen. We're going to see a downturn. And in order to keep this downturn from being a total shock to the economy and the financial markets, I think we just need to keep things going at a steady pace, and not to put any shocks in the system. Or if we're gonna, like for example, raise corporate taxes, we're gonna do it in a small way. We're not gonna do this huge jump that would have a big impact on companies, and then it trickles down to other people. So. Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. That I think the banks have gotten, you know, that it's good that the credit has gotten tighter. I don't like the bloat and you know, the bloat in these companies. I don't like the bloat in tech either. I think some of these large companies become very cocky. But I also do think it does provide an opportunity for newcomers to challenge that, or to provide, for example, you know, higher rates, less fees, you know, when you're talking about banks, to provide better customer service. You know, we've kind of gotten away from customer service, and those companies that have made individuals do all the work on their own, you know, there's I know Bank of America, for example, shutting all their branches and frankly just making it difficult to talk to somebody. There will be somebody who will capitalize on that. There will be a business that will say, hey, we're going to go back to providing the better service, or providing better fees. I mean, providing better rates or lower fees.
And I'm not a Florida dude like you. Illinois, you can't look at the world through Illinois, because Illinois was the last state in the union to allow branch banking. So we still have all kinds of banks. And by the way, we could probably start one up if we wanted to. I mean, I talked to a guy, it was a long time ago, but said if you had $1.5-2 million, you can start a bank if you know what you're doing. That number's probably gone to 5, but that's not a hell of a lot for a bank necessarily. But what is the status? I mean, I know kind of out west, well, at least I suspect, that they're much more dominated by the Wells Fargos and the Bank Americas and stuff. And you might not have, but I'm going to say, Greg, within 2,000 yards of here, we probably have 4 or 5 small banks. And if you go out like a mile or two, there's probably another 6 or 7. And I think that's somewhat Illinois unique. What's Florida like?
Yes.
Is Florida have? I mean, I could name you 10 banks within easy driving distance, like a couple of miles. Is Florida like that, or is Illinois still kind of unique with that?
I mean, Florida still has some you know, don't know, looks a little like the Northeast or say Illinois, because so many people have come from there. So there are still some smaller companies, but you're absolutely right about the West not having as many of the small, you know, regional banks. And it's kind of ironic because you think of the West as a place to that, you know, for opportunity and all that. So there's still the major players that dominate the market, I think, in terms of looking at the overall customer base. They take a very large, they have a very large market share. The smaller ones are tend to favor people who want that personal service, that where that's really important. But you're right, the barriers to entry to get into that business are really, really, really tough. And then also maintaining that business, being able to find the right talent to work there and all that, that's a challenge. I do think they've gotten big heads, you know, the larger banks, the larger tech companies, and who knows what's going to happen next that's going to cause some issues. I mean, we had a little bit of a taste of it with NVIDIA last week. We've had a little bit of a taste of it with SVC, Silicon Valley Bank. We haven't had enough of a taste of it yet for it to actually change things up or shake things up where we're going to have more of a level playing field going forward. But I think that will happen over time. I think we just have to have some faith in our American way.
Well, I do too. Hey, speaking of which, you and Greg, how come Superman's motto changed? Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
I saw some comic book nerds debating it online.
Well, okay, I can be a nerd for a second. I was watching, I was paging through and waiting for the Cub game last week. I had a half hour to kill, so one of the old Superman episodes came on, right? I'm watching, those are great. And it was truth, justice, and the American way, right? The American way had
truth, justice, better tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, it's now truth, justice, and a better tomorrow.
Right.
When people said the American way, you knew what you meant. You knew a straight place, help people out. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I could define the American way. Don't people
lying,
think
cheating,
of that anymore?
Stealing.
And no,
opportunity,
no.
Yeah.
Greg just said lying, cheating, stealing.
Well, you know, that's. I like to think of the glass being half full. So.
Well, you know, you got to be. I think you need to be careful, Dan, on a moral basis.
And
in a sense, on the trading floor,
used to be something like protecting the little guy.
Yeah.
Nah,
we're not doing that. And the trading floor, and Greg's been a trading floor guy too for a long time. And there's always going to be people that don't go to the beat of the same drummer. I mean, most people sit there and go, okay, we have traffic laws, we have trading laws, because if everybody does it this way, it's fair for everybody and everybody gets it. And
right.
Once in a while, there's going to be a few people that decide they're going to try and go around the curve, and you have to have people that catch those guys. I mean, right? They're just the way humans have been forever. But when you get something to the level, I mean, there are always a couple guys on the trading floor that you know, they would get wind of an order in the you know, in one of the booths, and would maybe magically appear and meet the broker on the floor, and you know, and everybody knew who the guys were and did their best to crowd them out of the trade because they were being idiots. There was a self-discipline there of people, but if you ever reach the point where if you're not cheating, you can't compete, that's dangerous, because then all of a sudden you got a real problem. I mean, if you're not driving on the shoulder, or if you're not going 50 miles an hour on the shoulder when everybody else has stopped, you can't get someplace. When you get there, all of a sudden society changes. And in some areas, you know, I think we sort of are. Certainly in the antitrust area we have, I think. But now, you have managed to get back to business. I mean, because we want people to, we'd love to have some clients that open up an account at IB and put their stock stuff with my firm and their fixed income stuff with Dan's firm. And I can't think of a better solution for people, Dan. You know, I guess some of that's ego. But I know I put up two accounts in the last week. And you know what, Dan? These are big time concentration issues.
Yep.
I don't know that anybody wants to service those people. We're talking about people with, you know, seven-figure dough that have like one stock and want to protect
right.
it. And I would no more drop that thing at Schwab or Fidelity and the man in the moon. I mean, guys like me that traded on the trading floor forever, and there aren't many of us around. There's probably a few guys, maybe a thinkorswim or somebody knows how to do that. But basically, it's a small group. And when you talk about people doing what Dan does, that's a small group. I think. I mean, how many Dans are there?
No.
You're not the only one, but there's, are there 20, 30 countrywide?
There aren't that many that actually go through the level of research that we go through and you know, provide a level of service as well. What I'll continue to say, and it isn't really just touting our own strategies, but this is actually the perfect time to be in our strategies, and just let the last 2 weeks be a good example of that, right?
Yep.
I talked at the beginning of the year, we were going to have a good year. It's an election year. We had a lot of tailwinds. But I also said, as the year goes on, we're going to see a lot of volatility. And I've been saying that all along. The volatility will increase as we approach the election. It'll increase as we approach year end. It'll increase as there are hits and misses in earnings. And that's exactly what's happening. And what we do, which is really what provides, I think, a fantastic alternative in this environment, is we provide absolute returns, positive returns, with a lot less risk. I mean, the risk part of the equation, people have really not paid attention to it. And now that they're dealing with volatility and seeing major swings in their 401ks and retirement plans on a day-to-day basis, or now that the baby boomers have retired or on the, you know, on the verge of retiring or have stepped down, suddenly their finances being stable, suddenly wanting to secure all their hard work over all the years is more important. And your strategy, my strategy, our strategies are the best in an environment like this for those people who have reached retirement, still have some money in the stock market, but diversify, get away from single stock risk, get away from money in the big seven or the big eight tech names, because that rally is ending. It's gonna level off. It's already leveling off, and it's gonna turn. And you want to retain and preserve as much of what you've earned over the years.
But Dan, your message, and I have the same message, you know that. How does your message land with people who maybe are up their behinds in NVIDIA, and there are a lot of people that are, and see the stock drop from 120 to damn near 100, maybe get concerned for a second, turn the TV on, 15 guys go, ah, don't worry about it, it's going to come right back up. And guess what? It has. I mean, it's
yeah, I think, right, and I hear what you say. I think what it is part of it is education on our part. I think part of it is letting people understand, you know, what risk is. So risk can mean different things to different people, and volatility is risk, right?
Oh, yeah.
So watching, if you're willing to stomach the ups and downs.
What do you mean? You just don't open your statement.
Right, but the thing is, depending, what I've told a couple of clients recently who've said, geez, you know, they had more exposure to equities, and geez, there's been, you know, we've seen it go down. I said, let's just wait a few weeks and we'll have the same conversation. So what you really have to establish right from the onset is what your level of risk is. How willing are you to be in there in the ups and downs? And you're right, it's like musical chairs. At some point, the chair is going to be pulled out, and you're going to be stuck saying, you know, geez, I didn't listen to those guys who've been doing this since, you know, forever and ever, who know that there's going to be a period that we're going to see some, this loss is going to stick, and it's just going to keep going down. So it's true with individual stocks, because there's stock specific risk. It's true with the market as a whole. The market will correct. It doesn't mean we're going to zero, but there will be a correction. It's just part of the cycle. It's been extended this time, but we will see a correction. And rates are coming down, which is great news for bonds.
We started a second late, so we'll go over like a minute or two. I have two specific questions for you. If somebody drops, you know, a bigger account, drops their fixed income portfolio on you, and I'm sure you've done this in the last few months, how much of it do you look at half of it and go, oh no, they're gone? or do you pretty much stick with stuff? Or do you look at it and say,
depending if it's a taxable account or a retirement account, if it's a taxable account, municipal bonds still look very attractive. So we're going to see rates continue to come down. So whether you're on the short end, don't know that I would definitely be going long in here, because there's still a fair amount of risk. If you're going to go with long dated bonds or longer maturities, longer duration, But I still think there's a lot of money to make in the shorter end, and I would say absolutely, you know, we would be fully invested in a fixed income.
Right now. I got two quick questions. One, the other one is my fear that if they don't do something pretty quick, whoever gets in office, at least some kind of a plan to attack it. I'm not saying you're going to fix the deficit in a day or a week or a year. If there isn't some sort of a plan out there, what are the chances of my fears of the 10-year rate going to like 11 or 12%? And it kind of ties in with question number two. We talk about a soft landing here. Guys, they talk about it all day long. And I wonder how many of the people who actually talk about it could even define what it is, but they talk about it no matter what. What is the chance of, and I'll use the term, even though I don't know, I'm sure as hell couldn't define it for them, what are the chances of a soft landing in China and they don't cause some sort of a mess, either by not showing up here to buy stuff or they're just not paying people, you know, some of the pension funds, the interest, or what are the chances of them causing an issue here, which means they got to get more money out of people here for the federal funds, and which means those interest rates are going to go up. Is that a domino thing that I should not even be worried about, or should I be worried about?
No, I think it's a good thing to be paying attention to right now. I mean, the slowdown in China is relevant. The demand has dropped. I mean, part of the reason that we're seeing lower oil prices is because of the drop in demand from China. So we do need to look at the global economy, and we're in a unique situation here in the United States, especially when we focus on things like technology. But China, the slowdown in China is definitely relevant, and it is something that's going to, you know, if we don't continue to have the demand from China, it's definitely going to affect our markets too.
What I lied. Last question. I have no idea who's going to win, but when I thought Kamala Harris answered the question when they tried to stick her on the fracking, how she said she didn't like fracking a few years ago, and now she's all of a sudden does like it, and she answered the question in a way that said, "Look, we all would like some clean energy, but what we want more is to be energy independent, and we're not going to be essentially pushed around by other countries. And by the way, oil is a big piece of that right now, as is a bunch of other stuff." I since that debate, if anybody hasn't watched it, all these little stocks, the oil stocks, even the little electric stocks, everything's going north. It's been a huge. Was it my brother some of his guys have money in these electric vehicle stuff? They've had the best couple of days they've had in forever. Now the stock's way down,
absolutely,
way down.
Absolutely.
But all of a sudden, I think when she said that, some of the fears. Now, of course, when people say what they do and whether they even get in, are, you know, it's a long time from now, but at least that is a much more sane answer, I think, than maybe most people expected.
No, absolutely. I think it was a very good answer. I think it was a very, very good response. And we have had, we've seen more production here in the United States. So it's just reality, and it's a good thing. It's a good reality.
I don't really shed much of a tear when the Arabs have less power. I've been around since '73, waiting in lines because of those guys. So I'm not a huge fan.
I remember the lines. Yeah.
If you saw a line, you pulled in. It means they had gas, right?
Right.
Dan, thank you. We ran all over. You take care of yourself. S&P futures now up 6. NASDAQ futures up 2. Well, we've been flopping back and forth off the flat line here. So we'll see as the day wears on what happens. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.